Side 5. The Bachman Books, 4 Early Novels. Continuing with The Long Walk on page 149. Ray? It was Art Baker. He had taken off his coat and slung it over one arm. Any particular reason you came on the long walk? Garrity unclipped his canteen and had a quick swallow of water. It was cool and good. It left beads of moisture on his upper lip and he licked them off. It was good. Good to feel things like that. I don't really know, he said truthfully. Me either, Baker thought for a moment. Did you go out for track or anything in school? No. Me either. But I guess it don't matter, does it? Not now. No, not now, Garrity asked. Conversation lulled. They passed through a small village with a country store and a gas station. Two old men sat on folding lawn chairs outside the gas station, watching them with hooded and reptilian old men's eyes. On the steps of the country store, a young woman held up her tiny son so he could see them. And a couple of older kids, around 12, Garrity judged, watched them out of sight wistfully. Some of the boys began to speculate about how much ground they had covered. The word came back that a second pacer half-track had been dispatched to cover the half a dozen boys in the vanguard. They were now completely out of sight. Someone said they were doing 7 miles an hour. Someone else said it was 10. Someone told them authoritatively that a guy up ahead was flagging and had been warned twice. Garrity wondered why they weren't catching up to him if that was true. Olson finished the Wafa chocolate bar he had started back at the border and drank some water. Some of the others were also eating, but Garrity decided to wait until he was really hungry. He had heard the concentrates were quite good. The astronauts got them when they went into space. A little after 10 o'clock, they passed a sign that said, Limestone, 10 miles. Garrity thought about the only long walk his father had ever let him go to. They went to Freeport and watched them walk through. His mother had been with them. The walkers were tired and hollow-eyed and barely conscious of the cheering and the waving signs and the constant hoorah as people cheered on their favorites and those on whom they had wagered. His father told him later that day that people lined the roads from Bangor on. Up country it wasn't so interesting, and the road was strictly cordoned off, maybe so they could concentrate on being calm, as Barkovich had said. But as time passed, it got better, of course. When the walkers passed through Freeport that year, they had been on the road over 72 hours. Garrity had been 10 and overwhelmed by everything. The major had made a speech to the crowd while the boys were still 5 miles out of town. He began with competition, progressed to patriotism, and finished with something called the gross national product. Garrity had laughed at that because to him gross meant something nasty like boogers. He had eaten 6 hot dogs, and when he finally saw the walkers coming, he had wet his pants. One boy had been screaming. That was his most vivid memory. Every time he put his foot down, he had screamed, I can't, I can't, I can't, I can't. But he went on walking. They all did. And pretty soon the last of them had gone past L.L. Bean's on U.S. 1 and out of sight. Garrity had been mildly disappointed at not seeing anyone get a ticket. He had never gone to another long walk. Later that night, Garrity had heard his father shouting thickly at someone into the telephone, the way he did when he was being drunk or political, and his mother in the background, her conspiratorial whisper, begging him to stop, please stop, before someone picked up the party line. Garrity drank some more water and wondered how Barkovich was making it. They were passing more houses now. Families sat out on their front lawns, smiling, waving, drinking Coca-Colas. Garrity, McFree said, my, my, look what you got. A pretty girl of about 16 in a white blouse and red-checked pedal pushers was holding up a big magic marker sign. Go, go, Garrity, number 47. We love you, Ray, Maine's own. Garrity felt his heart swell. He suddenly knew he was going to win. The unnamed girl proved it. Olson whistled wetly and began to slide his stiff index finger rapidly in and out of his loosely curled fist. Garrity thought that was a pretty goddamn sick thing to be doing. To hell with hint 13. Garrity ran over to the side of the road. The girl saw his number and squealed. She threw herself at him and kissed him hard. Garrity was suddenly, sweatily aroused. He kissed back vigorously. The girl poked her tongue into his mouth twice, delicately. Hardly aware of what he was doing, he put one hand on a round buttock and squeezed gently. "Warning, warning, 47. Garrity stepped back and grinned. "Thanks. Oh, sure. Her eyes were starry. He tried to think of something else to say, but he could see the soldier opening his mouth to give him the second warning. He trotted back to his place, panting a little and grinning. He felt a little guilty after Hint 13 just the same, though. Olsen was also grinning. "For that, I would have taken three warnings." Garrity didn't answer, but he turned around and walked backward and waved to the girl. When she was out of sight, he turned around and began to walk firmly. An hour before his warning would be gone. He must be careful not to get another one. But he felt good. He felt fit. He felt like he could walk all the way to Florida. He started to walk faster. "Ray," McVries was still smiling. "What's your hurry?" Yeah, that was right. Hint 6. Slow and easy, does it? "Thanks." McVries went on smiling. "Don't thank me too much. I'm out to win, too." Garrity stared at him, disconcerted. "I mean, let's not put this on a Three Musketeers basis. I like you, and it's obvious you're a big hit with the pretty girls. But if you fall over, I won't pick you up." "Yeah." He smiled back, but his smile felt lame. "On the other hand," Baker drawled softly, "we're all in this together, and we might as well keep each other amused." McVries smiled. "Why not?" They came to an upslope and saved their breath for walking. Halfway up, Garrity took off his jacket and slung it over his shoulder. A few moments later, they passed someone's discarded sweater lying on the road. Someone, Garrity thought, is going to wish they had that tonight. Up ahead, a couple of the point walkers were losing ground. Garrity concentrated on picking them up and putting them down. He still felt good. He felt strong. Chapter 2. "Now you have the money, Ellen, and that's yours to keep. Unless, of course, you'd like to trade it for what's behind the curtain. Monty Hall, let's make a deal." "I'm Harkness, number 49. You're Garrity, number 47, right?" Garrity looked at Harkness, who wore glasses and had a crew cut. Harkness's face was red and sweaty. "That's right." Harkness had a notebook. He wrote Garrity's name and number in it. The script was strange and jerky, bumping up and down as he walked. He ran into a fellow named Collie Parker who told him to watch where the fuck he was going. Garrity suppressed a smile. "I'm taking down everyone's name and number," Harkness said. When he looked up, the mid-morning sun sparkled on the lenses of his glasses, and Garrity had to squint to see his face. It was 10:30, and they were 8 miles out of Limestone, and they had only 1.75 miles to go to beat the record of the farthest distance traveled by a complete long-walk group. "I suppose you're wondering why I'm writing down everyone's name and number," Harkness said. "You're with the squads," Olsen cracked over his shoulder. "No, I'm going to write a book," Harkness said pleasantly. "When this is all over, I'm going to write a book." Garrity grinned. "If you win, you're going to write a book, you mean?" Harkness shrugged. "Yes, I suppose. But look at this. A book about the long walk from an insider's point of view could make me a rich man." McVries burst out laughing. "If you win, you won't need a book to make you a rich man, will you?" Harkness frowned. "Well, I suppose not. But it would still make one heck of an interesting book, I think." They walked on, and Harkness continued taking names and numbers. Most gave them willingly enough, joshing him about the great book. Now they had come 6 miles. The word came back that it looked good for breaking the record. Garrity speculated briefly on why they should want to break the record anyhow. The quicker the competition dropped out, the better the odds became for those remaining. He supposed it was a matter of pride. The word also came back that thunder showers were forecast for the afternoon. Someone had a transistor radio, Garrity supposed. If it was true, it was bad news. Early May thunder showers weren't the warmest. They kept walking. McVries walked firmly, keeping his head up and swinging his arms slightly. He had tried the shoulder, but fighting the loose soil there had made him give it up. He hadn't been warned, and if the knapsack was giving him any trouble or chafing, he showed no sign. His eyes were always searching the horizon. When they passed small clusters of people, he waved and smiled his thin-lipped smile. He showed no signs of tiring. Baker ambled along, moving in a kind of knee-bent shuffle that seemed to cover the ground when you weren't looking. He swung his coat idly, smiled at the pointing people, and sometimes whistled a low snatch of some tune or other. God, they thought he looked like he could go on forever. Olson wasn't talking so much anymore, and every few moments he would bend one knee swiftly. Each time, Garrity could hear the joint pop. Olson was stiffening up a little, Garrity thought, beginning to show 6 miles of walking. Garrity judged that one of his canteens must be almost empty. Olson would have to pee before too long. Barkovich kept up the same jerky pace, now ahead of the main group as if to catch up with the vanguard walkers, now dropping back toward Stebbins's position on drag. He lost one of his 3 warnings and gained it back 5 minutes later. Garrity decided he must like it there on the edge of nothing. Stebbins just kept on walking off by himself. Garrity hadn't seen him speak to anybody. He wondered if Stebbins was lonely or tired. He still thought Stebbins would fold up early, maybe first, although he didn't know why he thought so. Stebbins had taken off the old green sweater, and he carried the last jelly sandwich in his hand. He looked at no one. His face was a mask. They walked on. The road was crossed by another, and policemen were holding up traffic as the walkers passed. They saluted each walker, and a couple of the boys, secure in their immunity, thumbed their noses. Garrity didn't approve. He smiled and nodded to acknowledge the police and wondered if the police thought they were all crazy. The cars honked, and then some woman yelled out to her son. She had parked beside the road, apparently waiting to make sure her boy was still along for the walk. "Percy! Percy!" It was 31. He blushed, then waved a little, and then hurried on with his head slightly bent. The woman tried to run out into the road. The guards on the top deck of the half-track stiffened, but one of the policemen caught her arm and restrained her gently. Then the road curved, and the intersection was out of sight. They passed across a wooden-slatted bridge. A small brook gurgled its way underneath. Garrity walked close to the railing, and looking over, he could see, for just a moment, a distorted image of his own face. They passed a sign which read, "Limestone, 7 miles," and then under a rippling banner which said, "Limestone is proud to welcome the Long Walkers." Garrity figured they had to be less than a mile from breaking the record. Then the word came back, and this time the word was about a boy named Curly, number 7. Curly had a Charlie horse and had already picked up his first warning. Garrity put on some speed and came even with McVries and Olson. "Where is he?" Olson jerked his thumb at a skinny, gangling boy in blue jeans. Curly had been trying to cultivate sideburns. The sideburns had failed. His lean and earnest face was now set in lines of terrific concentration, and he was staring at his right leg. He was favoring it. He was losing ground, and his face showed it. "Warning! Warning, 7! Curly began to force himself faster. He was panting a little, as much from fear as from his exertions, Garrity thought. Garrity lost all track of time. He forgot everything but Curly. He watched him struggle, realizing in a numb sort of way that this might be his struggle an hour from now, or a day from now. It was the most fascinating thing he had ever seen. Curly fell back slowly, and several warnings were issued to others before the group realized they were adjusting to his speed in their fascination, which meant Curly was very close to the edge. "Warning! Warning, 7! Third warning, 7! "I've got a Charlie horse!" Curly shouted hoarsely. "It ain't no fair if you've got a Charlie horse!" He was almost beside Garrity now. Garrity could see Curly's Adam's apple going up and down. Curly was massaging his leg frantically, and Garrity could smell panic coming off Curly in waves, and it was like the smell of a ripe, freshly cut lemon. Garrity began to pull ahead of him, and the next moment Curly exclaimed, "Thank God! She's loosening!" No one said anything. Garrity felt a grudging disappointment. It was mean and unsporting, he supposed, but he wanted to be sure someone got a ticket before he did. Who wants to bow out first? Garrity's watch said 11:05 now. He supposed that meant they had beaten the record, figuring 2 hours times 4 miles an hour. They would be in Limestone soon. He saw Olson flex first one knee, then the other, again. Curious, he tried it himself. His knee joints popped audibly, and he was surprised to find how much stiffness had settled into them. Still, his feet didn't hurt. That was something. They passed a milk truck parked at the head of a small dirt feeder road. The milkman was sitting on the hood. He waved good-naturedly. "Go to it, boys!" Garrity felt suddenly angry. Felt like yelling. "Why don't you just get up off your fat ass and go to it with us?" But the milkman was past 18. In fact, he looked well past 30. He was old. "Okay, everybody, take 5. Olson cracked suddenly and got some laughs. The milk truck was out of sight. There were more roads now, more policemen, and people honking and waving. Someone threw confetti. Garrity began to feel important. He was, after all, Maine's own. Suddenly, Curly screamed. Garrity looked back over his shoulder. Curly was doubled over, holding his leg and screaming. Somehow, incredibly, he was still walking, but very slowly, much too slowly. Everything went slowly then, as if to match the way Curly was walking. The soldiers on the back of the slow-moving half-track raised their guns. The crowd gasped, as if they hadn't known this was the way it was, and the walkers gasped, as if they hadn't known, and Garrity gasped with them, but of course he had known. Of course they had all known. It was very simple. Curly was going to get his ticket. The safeties clicked off. Boys scattered from around Curly like quail. He was suddenly alone on the sun-washed road. "It isn't fair," he screamed. "It just isn't fair." The walking boys entered a leafy glade of shadow, some of them looking back, some of them looking straight ahead, afraid to see. Garrity was looking. He had to look. The scatter of waving spectators had fallen silent, as if someone had simply clicked them all off. "It isn't..." 4 carbines fired. They were very loud. The noise traveled away like bowling balls, struck the hills, and rolled back. Curly's angular, pimply head disappeared in a hammer smash of blood and brains and flying skull fragments. The rest of him fell forward on the white line like a sack of mail. 99 now, Garrity thought sickly. 99 bottles of beer on the wall, and if one of those bottles should happen to fall, oh Jesus, oh Jesus. Stebbins stepped over the body. His foot slid a little in some of the blood, and his next step with that foot left a bloody track, like a photograph in an official detective magazine. Stebbins didn't look down at what was left of Curly. His face didn't change expression. "Stebbins, you bastard," Garrity thought. "You were supposed to get your ticket first, didn't you know?" Then Garrity looked away. He didn't want to be sick. He didn't want to vomit. A woman beside a Volkswagen bus put her face in her hands. She made odd noises in her throat, and Garrity found he could look right up her dress to her underpants, her blue underpants. Inexplicably, he found himself aroused again. A fat man with a bald head was staring at Curly and rubbing frantically at a wart beside his ear. He wet his large, thick lips and went on looking and rubbing the wart. He was still looking when Garrity passed him by. They walked on. Garrity found himself walking with Olson, Baker, and McBreeze again. They were almost protectively bunched up. All of them were looking straight ahead now, their faces carefully expressionless. The echoes of the carbines seemed to hang in the air still. Garrity kept thinking about the bloody footprint that Stebbins' tennis shoe had left. He wondered if it was still tracking red, almost turned his head to look, then told himself not to be a fool, but he couldn't help wondering. He wondered if it had hurt Curly. He wondered if Curly had felt the gas-tipped slugs hitting home, or if he had just been alive 1 second and dead the next. But of course it had hurt. It had hurt before, in the worst rupturing way, knowing there would be no more you, but the universe would roll on just the same, unharmed and unhampered. The word came back that they had made almost 9 miles before Curly bought his ticket. The major was said to be as pleased as punch. Garrity wondered how anyone could know where the hell the major was. He looked back suddenly, wanting to know what was being done with Curly's body, but they had already rounded another curve. Curly was out of sight. "What have you got in that pack sack?" Baker asked McBreeze suddenly. He was making an effort to be strictly conversational, but his voice was high and reedy, near to cracking. "A fresh shirt," McBreeze said, "and some raw hamburger." "Raw hamburger?" Olson made a sick face. "Good fast energy in raw hamburger. McFreeze said. You're off your trolley. You'll puke all over the place. McFreeze only smiled. Garrity kind of wished he had brought some raw hamburger himself. He didn't know about fast energy, but he liked raw hamburger. It beat chocolate bars and concentrates. Suddenly, he thought of his cookies. But after Curly, he wasn't very hungry. After Curly, could he really have been thinking about eating raw hamburger? The word that one of the walkers had been ticketed out ran through the spectators, and for some reason they began to cheer even more loudly. Thin applause crackled like popcorn. Garrity wondered if it was embarrassing, being shot in front of people, and guessed by the time you got to that you probably didn't give a tin whistle. Curly hadn't looked as if he gave a tin whistle, certainly. Having to relieve yourself, though, that would be bad. Garrity decided not to think about that. The hands on his watch now stood firmly straight up at noon. They crossed a rusty iron bridge spanning a high, dry gorge, and on the other side was a sign reading, Entering Limestone City Limits. Welcome, Long Walkers. Some of the boys cheered, but Garrity saved his breath. The road widened, and the walkers spread across it comfortably, the groups loosening up a little. After all, Curly was 3 miles back now. Garrity took out his cookies, and for a moment turned the foil package over in his hands. He thought homesickly of his mother, then stuffed the feeling aside. He would see Mom and Jan in Freeport. That was a promise. He ate a cookie and felt a little better. You know something? McFreeze said. Garrity shook his head. He took a swig from his canteen and waved at an elderly couple sitting beside the road with a small cardboard Garrity sign. I have no idea what I'll want if I do win this, McFreeze said. There's nothing that I really need. I mean, I don't have a sick old mother sitting home or a father on a kidney machine or anything. I don't even have a little brother dying gamely of leukemia. He laughed and unstrapped his canteen. You've got a point there, Garrity agreed. You mean I don't have a point there. The whole thing is pointless. You don't really mean that, Garrity said confidently. If you had to do it all over again... Yeah, I'd still do it, but... Hey! The boy ahead of them, Pearson, pointed. Sidewalks! They were finally coming into the town proper. Handsome houses set back from the road looked down at them from the vantage of ascending green lawns. The lawns were crowded with people waving and cheering. It seemed to Garrity that almost all of them were sitting down. Sitting on the ground, on lawn chairs, like the old men back at the gas station. Sitting on picnic tables. Even sitting on swings and porch gliders. He felt a touch of jealous anger. Go ahead and wave your asses off. I'll be damned if I'll wave back anymore. Hint 13. Conserve energy whenever possible. But finally he decided he was being foolish. People might decide he was getting snotty. He was, after all, Maine's own. He decided he would wave to all the people with Garrity signs. And to all the pretty girls. Side streets and cross streets moved steadily past. Sycamore Street and Clark Avenue, Exchange Street and Juniper Lane. They passed a corner grocery with a Narragansett beer sign in the window, and a five and dime plastered with pictures of the Major. The sidewalks were lined with people, but thinly lined. On the whole, Garrity was disappointed. He knew the real crowds would come further down the line, but it was still something of a wet firecracker. And poor old Curly had missed even this. The Major's jeep suddenly spurted out of a side street and began pacing the main group. The vanguard was still some distance ahead. A tremendous cheer went up. The Major nodded and smiled and waved at the crowd. Then he made a neat left face and saluted the boys. Garrity felt a thrill go straight up his back. The Major's sunglasses glinted in the early afternoon sunlight. The Major raised the battery-powered loudhailer to his lips. I'm proud of you, boys. Proud. From somewhere behind Garrity, a voice said softly but clearly, Diddly shit. Garrity turned his head, but there was no one back there but 4 or 5 boys watching the Major intently. One of them realized he was saluting and dropped his hand sheepishly. And Stebbins. Stebbins did not even seem to be looking at the Major. The jeep roared ahead. A moment later, the Major was gone again. They reached downtown Limestone around 12:30. Garrity was disappointed. It was pretty much of a one-hydrant town. There was a business section, and 3 used car lots, and a McDonald's, and a Burger King, and a Pizza Hut, and an industrial park. And that was Limestone. "It isn't very big, is it?" Baker said. Olson laughed. "It's probably a nice place to live," Garrity said defensively. "God spare me from nice places to live," McGree said, but he was smiling. "Well, what turns you on?" Garrity said lamely. By 1 o'clock, Limestone was a memory. A small, swaggering boy in patched denim overalls walked along with them for almost a mile, then sat down and watched them go by. The country grew hillier. Garrity felt the first real sweat of the day coming out on him. His shirt was patched to his back. On his right, thunderheads were forming, but they were still far away. There was a light circulating breeze, and that helped a little. "What's the next big town, Garrity?" McBreeze asked. "Caribou, I guess." He was wondering if Stebbins had eaten his last sandwich yet. Stebbins had gotten into his head like a snatch of pop music that goes around and around until you think you're going to go crazy with it. It was 1:30. The long walk had progressed through 18 miles. "How far is that?" Garrity wondered what the record was for miles walked with only one walker punched out. 18 miles seemed pretty good to him. 18 miles was a figure a man could be proud of. "I walked 18 miles. 18. I said," McVries began patiently, "maybe 30 miles from here."
30, Pearson said. "Jesus."
"It's a bigger town than Limestone," Garrity said. He was still feeling defensive. God knew why. Maybe because so many of these boys would die here. Maybe all of them. Probably all of them. Only 6 long walks in history had ended over the state line in New Hampshire, and only 1 had gotten into Massachusetts, and the expert said that was like Hank Aaron hitting 730 home runs, or whatever it was, a record that would never be equaled. Maybe he would die here, too. Maybe he would. But that was different. Native soil. He had an idea the major would like that. He died on his native soil. He tipped his canteen up and found it was empty. "Canteen," he called. 47 calling for canteen. One of the soldiers jumped off the half-track and brought over a fresh canteen. When he turned away, Garrity touched the carbine slung over the soldier's back. He did it furtively, but McVree saw him.
"Why'd you do that?"
Garrity grinned and felt confused. "I don't know, like knocking on wood, maybe." "You're a dear boy, Ray," McVries said, and then put on some speed and caught up with Olson, leaving Garrity to walk alone, feeling more confused than ever. Number 93, Garrity didn't know his name, walked past him on Garrity's right. He was staring down at his feet, and his lips moved soundlessly as he counted his paces. He was weaving slightly. "Hi," Garrity said. 93 cringed. There was a blankness in his eyes, the same blankness that had been in Curly's eyes while he was losing his fight with the Charlie horse. "He's tired," Garrity thought. "He knows it, and he's scared." Garrity suddenly felt his stomach tip over and right itself slowly. Their shadows walked alongside them now. It was 2:15. 9 in the morning, cool, sitting on the grass in the shade, was a month back. At just before 2, the word came back again. Garrity was getting a first-hand lesson in the psychology of the grapevine. Someone found something out, and suddenly it was all over. Rumors were created by mouth-to-mouth respiration. "It looks like rain. Chances are it's going to rain. It's going to rain pretty soon. The guy with the radio says it's going to shit potatoes pretty quick." But it was funny how often the grapevine was right. And when the word came back that someone was slowing up, that someone was in trouble, the grapevine was always right. This time the word was that number 9, Ewing, had developed blisters and had been warned twice. Lots of boys had been warned, but that was normal. The word was that things looked bad for Ewing. He passed the word to Baker, and Baker looked surprised. "The black fella?" Baker said. "So black he looks sort of blue?" Garrity said he didn't know if Ewing was black or white. "Yeah, he's black," Pearson said. He pointed to Ewing. Garrity could see tiny jewels of perspiration gleaming in Ewing's natural, with something like horror Garrity observed that Ewing was wearing sneakers. Hint 3, do not repeat, do not wear sneakers. Nothing will give you blisters faster than sneakers on a long walk. He rode up with us, Baker said. He's from Texas. Baker picked up his pace until he was walking with Ewing. He talked with Ewing for quite a while. Then he dropped back slowly to avoid getting warned himself. His face was bleak. He started to blister up 2 miles out. They started to break back in limestone. He's walking in pus from broken blisters. They all listened silently. Garrity thought of Stebbins again. Stebbins was wearing tennis shoes. Maybe Stebbins was fighting blisters right now. Warning! Warning 9! This is your third warning 9! The soldiers were watching Ewing carefully now. So were the walkers. Ewing was in the spotlight. The back of his T-shirt, startlingly white against his black skin, was sweat-stained gray straight down the middle. Garrity could see the big muscles in his back ripple as he walked. Muscles enough to last for days. And Baker said he was walking in pus, blisters, and charley horses. Garrity shivered. Sudden death. All those muscles, all the training, couldn't stop blisters and charley horses. What in the name of God had Ewing been thinking about when he put on those PF flyers? Barkovich joined them. Barkovich was looking at Ewing, too. Blisters! He made it sound like Ewing's mother was a whore. What the hell can you expect from a dumb nigger, now I ask you? Move away, Baker said evenly, or I'll poke you. It's against the rules, Barkovich said with a smirk. Keep it in mind, Cracker. But he moved away. It was as if he took a small poison cloud with him. 2 o'clock became 2:30. Their shadows got longer. They walked up a long hill, and at the crest, Garrity could see low mountains, hazy and blue, in the distance. The encroaching thunderheads to the west were darker now, and the breeze had stiffened, making his flesh goosebump as the sweat dried on him. A group of men clustered around a Ford pickup truck with a camper on the back cheered them crazily. The men were all very drunk. They all waved back at the men, even Ewing. They were the first spectators they had seen since the swaggering little boy in the patched overalls. Garrity broke open a concentrate tube without reading the label and ate it. It tasted slightly porky. He thought about McVreeze's hamburger. He thought about a great big chocolate cake with a cherry on the top. He thought about flapjacks. For some crazy reason, he wanted a cold flapjack full of apple jelly. The cold lunch his mother always made when he and his father went hunting in November. Ewing bought a hole about 10 minutes later. He was clustered in with a group of boys when he fell below speed for the last time. Maybe he thought the boys would protect him. The soldiers did their job well. The soldiers were experts. They pushed the other boys aside. They dragged Ewing over to the shoulder. Ewing tried to fight, but not much. One of the soldiers pinned Ewing's arms behind him, while the other put his carbine up to Ewing's head and shot him. One leg kicked convulsively. "He bleeds the same color as anyone else," McVreeze said suddenly. It was very loud in the stillness after the single shot. His Adam's apple bobbed and something clicked in his throat. Two of them gone now. The odds infinitesimally adjusted in favor of those remaining. There was some subdued talk, and Garrity wondered again what they did with the bodies. "You wonder too goddamn much," he shouted at himself suddenly, and realized he was tired. Part 2. Going Down the Road. Chapter 3. You will have 30 seconds, and please remember that your answer must be in the form of a question. Art Fleming, Jeopardy. It was 3 o'clock when the first drops of rain fell on the road, big and dark and round. The sky overhead was tattered and black, wild and fascinating. Thunder clapped hands somewhere above the clouds. A blue fork of lightning went to earth somewhere up ahead. Garrity had donned his coat shortly after Ewing had gotten his ticket. And now he zipped it and turned up his collar. Harkness, the potential author, had carefully stowed his notebook in a baggie. Barkovich had put on a yellow vinyl rain hat. There was something incredible about what it did to his face, but you would have been hard put to say just what. He peered out from beneath it like a truculent lighthouse keeper. There was a stupendous crack of thunder. "Here it comes," Olson cried. The rain came pouring down. For a few moments it was so heavy that Garrity found himself totally isolated inside an undulating shower curtain. He was immediately soaked to the skin. His hair became a dripping pelt. He turned his face up into the rain, grinning. He wondered if the soldiers could see them. He wondered if a person might conceivably... While he was still wondering, the first vicious onslaught let up a little and he could see again. He looked over his shoulder at Stebbins. Stebbins was walking hunched over, his hands hooked against his belly, and at first Garrity thought he had a cramp. For a moment, Garrity was in the grip of a strong panicky feeling, nothing at all like he had felt when Curly and Ewing bought it. He didn't want Stebbins to fold up early anymore. Then he saw Stebbins was only protecting the last half of his jelly sandwich, and he faced forward again, feeling relieved. He decided Stebbins must have a pretty stupid mother not to wrap his goddamn sandwiches in foil just in case of rain. Thunder cracked stridently. Artillery practice in the sky. Garrity felt exhilarated, and some of his tiredness seemed to wash away with the sweat from his body. The rain came again, hard and pelting, and finally let off into a steady drizzle. Overhead, the clouds began to tatter. Pearson was now walking beside him. He hitched up his pants. He was wearing jeans that were too big for him, and he hitched up his pants often. He wore horn-rimmed glasses, with lenses like the bottoms of Coke bottles, and now he whipped them off and began to clean them on the tail of his shirt. He goggled in that myopic, defenseless way that people with very poor eyesight have when their glasses are off. "Enjoy your shower, Garrity?" Garrity nodded. Up ahead, McVries was urinating. He was walking backward while he did it, spraying the shoulder considerately away from the others. Garrity looked up at the soldiers. They were wet, too, of course, but if they were uncomfortable, they didn't show it. Their faces were perfectly wooden. "I wonder what it feels like," he thought, "just to shoot someone down. I wonder if it makes them feel powerful." He remembered the girl with the sign, kissing her, feeling her ass, feeling her smooth underpants under her pedal pushers. That had made him feel powerful. "That guy back there sure doesn't say much, does he?" Baker said suddenly. He jerked a thumb at Stebbins. Stebbins's purple pants were almost black now that they were soaked through. "No. No, he doesn't." McVries pulled a warning for slowing down too much to zip up his fly. They pulled even with him, and Baker repeated what he had said about Stebbins. "He's a loner, so what?" McVries said and shrugged. "I think..." "Hey," Olson broke in. It was the first thing he had said in some time, and he sounded queer. "My legs feel funny." Garrity looked at Olson closely and saw the seedling panic in his eyes already. The look of bravado was gone. "How funny?" he asked. "Like the muscles are all turning baggy." "Relax," McVries said. "It happened to me a couple of hours ago. It passes off." Relief showed in Olson's eyes.
"Does it?"
"Yeah, sure it does." Olson didn't say anything, but his lips moved. Garrity thought for a moment he was praying, but then he realized he was just counting his paces. Two shots rang out suddenly. There was a cry, then a third shot. They looked and saw a boy in a blue sweater and dirty white clam diggers lying face down in a puddle of water. One of his shoes had come off. Garrity saw he had been wearing white athletic socks. Hint 12 recommended them. Garrity stepped over him, not looking too closely for holes. The word came back that this boy had died of slowing down. Not blisters or a Charlie horse. He had just slowed down once too often and got a ticket. Garrity didn't know his name or number. He thought the word would come back on that, but it never did. Maybe nobody knew. Maybe he had been a loner like Stebbins. Now they were 25 miles into the long walk. The scenery blended into a continuous mural of woods and fields, broken by an occasional house or a crossroads where waving, cheering people stood in spite of the dying drizzle. One old lady stood frozenly beneath a black umbrella, neither waving nor speaking nor smiling. She watched them go by with gimlet eyes. There was not a sign of life or movement about her, except for the wind-twitched hem of her black dress. On the middle finger of her right hand, she wore a large ring with a purple stone. There was a tarnished cameo at her throat. They crossed a railroad track that had been abandoned long ago. The rails were rusty, and witchgrass was growing in the cinders between the ties. Somebody stumbled and fell and was warned and got up and went on walking with a bleeding knee. It was only 19 miles to Caribou, but dark would come before that. No rest for the wicked, Carroty thought. And that struck him funny. He laughed. McCreas looked at him closely. Getting tired? No, Carroty said. I've been tired for quite a while now. He looked at McVries with something like animosity. You mean you're not? McVries said, Just go on dancing with me like this forever, Garrity, and I'll never tire. We'll scrape our shoes on the stars and hang upside down from the moon. He blew Garrity a kiss and walked away. Garrity looked after him. He didn't know what to make of McVries. By 4:15, the sky had cleared, and there was a rainbow in the west, where the sun was sitting below gold-edged clouds. Slanting rays of the late afternoon sunlight colored the newly turned fields they were passing, making the furrows sharp and black where they contoured around the long, sloping hills. The sound of the half-track was quiet, almost soothing. Garrity let his head drop forward and semi-dozed as he walked. Somewhere up ahead was Freeport. Not tonight or tomorrow, though. Lot of steps. Long way to go. He found himself still with too many questions and not enough answers. The whole walk seemed nothing but one looming question mark. He told himself that a thing like this must have some deep meaning. Surely it was so. A thing like this must provide an answer to every question. It was just a matter of keeping your foot on the throttle. Now, if he could only. He put his foot down in a puddle of water and started fully awake again. Pearson looked at him quizzically and pushed his glasses up on his nose. You know that guy that fell down and cut himself when we were crossing the tracks? Yeah, it was Zuck, wasn't it? Yeah. I just heard he's still bleeding. How far to Caribou, maniac? Somebody asked him. Garrity looked around. It was Barkovich. He had tucked his rain hat into his back pocket, where it flapped obscenely. How the hell should I know? You live here, don't you? It's about 17 miles, McVries told him. Now go peddle your papers, little man. Barkovich put on his insulted look and moved away. He's some hot ticket, Garrity said. Don't let him get under your skin, McVries replied. Just concentrate on walking him into the ground. Okay, coach. McVries patted Garrity on the shoulder. You're going to win this one for the Gipper, my boy. It seems like we've been walking forever, doesn't it? Yeah. Garrity licked his lips, wanting to express himself and not knowing just how. Did you ever hear that bit about a drowning man's life passing before his eyes? I think I read it once, or heard someone say it in a movie. Have you ever thought that might happen to us, on the walk? McVries pretended to shudder. Christ, I hope not. Garrity was silent for a moment and then said, Do you think? Never mind. The hell with it. No, go on. Do I think what? Do you think we could live the rest of our lives on this road? That's what I meant. The part we would have had if we hadn't, you know. McVries fumbled in his pocket and came up with a package of mellow cigarettes. Smoke? I don't. Neither do I, McVries said, and then put a cigarette into his mouth. He found a book of matches with a tomato sauce recipe on it. He lit the cigarette, drew smoke in, and coughed it out. Garrity thought of hint 10. Save your wind. If you smoke ordinarily, try not to smoke on the long walk. I thought I'd learn, McVries said defiantly. It's crap, isn't it? Garrity said sadly. McVries looked at him, surprised, and then threw the cigarette away. Yeah, he said, I think it is. The rainbow was gone by 4 o'clock. Davidson, 8, dropped back with them. He was a good-looking boy, except for the rash of acne on his forehead. That guy Zuck's really hurting, Davidson said. He had had a pack sack the last time Garrity saw him, but he noticed that at some point Davidson had cast it away.
Still bleeding? McFreeze asked. Like a stuck pig.
Davidson shook his head.
It's funny the way things turn out, isn't it? You fall down any other time, you get a little scrape.
He needs stitches. He pointed to the road.
Look at that.
Garrity looked and saw tiny, dark spots on the drying hardtop.
Blood?
It ain't molasses, Davidson said grimly.
Is he scared? Olson asked in a dry voice.
He says he doesn't give a damn, Davidson said.
But I'm scared.
His eyes were wide and gray.
I'm scared for all of us.
They kept on walking. Baker pointed out another Garrity sign.
Hot shit,
Garrity said without looking up. He was following the trail of Zuck's blood like Dan'l Boone tracking a wounded Indian. It weaved slowly back and forth across the white line.
McFreeze, Olson said. His voice had gotten softer in the last couple of hours.
Garrity had decided he liked Olson in spite of Olson's brass balls outer face. He didn't like to see Olson getting scared, but there could be no doubt that he was.
What?
McFreeze said.
It isn't going away. That baggy feeling I told you about. It isn't going away.
McFreeze didn't say anything. The scar on his face looked very white in the light of the setting sun.
It feels like my legs could just collapse, like a bad foundation. That won't happen, will it? Will it?
Olson's voice had gotten a little shrill. McFreeze didn't say anything.
Could I have a cigarette?
Olson asked. His voice was low again.
Yeah, you can keep the pack.
Olson lit one of the mellows with practiced ease, cupping the match, and thumbed his nose at one of the soldiers watching him from the half-track.
They've been giving me the old hairy eyeball for the last hour or so. They've got a sixth sense about it.
He raised his voice again.
You like it, don't you, fellas? You like it, right? That goddamn right, is it?
Several of the walkers looked around at him, and then looked away quickly. Garrity wanted to look away, too. There was hysteria in Olson's voice. The soldiers looked at Olson impassively. Garrity wondered if the word would go back on Olson pretty quick, and couldn't repress a shudder. By 4:30, they had covered 30 miles. The sun was half gone, and it had turned blood red on the horizon. The thunderheads had moved east, and overhead the sky was a darkening blue. Garrity thought about his hypothetical drowning man again. Not so hypothetical as that. The coming night was like water that would soon cover them. A feeling of panic rose in his gullet. He was suddenly and terribly sure that he was looking at the last daylight in his life. He wanted it to stretch out. He wanted it to last. He wanted the dusk to go on for hours.
Warning, warning 100, your third warning 100.
Zuck looked around. There was a dazed, uncomprehending look in his eyes. His right pants leg was caked with dried blood. And then suddenly he began to sprint. He weaved through the walkers like a broken field runner carrying a football. He ran with that same dazed expression on his face. The half-track picked up speed. Zuck heard it coming and ran faster. It was a queer, shambling, limping run. The wound on his knee broke open again, and as he burst into the open ahead of the main pack, Garrity could see the drops of fresh blood splashing and flying from the cuff of his pants. Zuck ran up the next rise, and for a moment he was starkly silhouetted against the red sky, a galvanic black shape, frozen for a moment in mid-stride like a scarecrow in full flight. Then he was gone, and the half-track followed. The two soldiers that had dropped off it trudged along with the boys, their faces empty. Nobody said a word. They only listened. There was no sound for a long time. An incredibly, unbelievably long time. Only a bird and a few early May crickets. And somewhere behind them, the drone of a plane. Then there was a single sharp report, a pause, then a second.
Making sure, someone said sickly.
When they got up over the rise, they saw the half-track sitting on the shoulder half a mile away. Blue smoke was coming from its dual exhaust pipes. Of Zuck, there was no sign.
No sign at all. "Where's the Major?" someone screamed. The voice was on the raw edge of panic. It belonged to a bullet-headed boy named Gribble, number 48. "I want to see the Major, goddammit! Where is he?" The soldiers walking along the verge of the road did not answer. No one answered. "Is he making another speech?" Gribble stormed. "Is that what he's doing? Well, he's a murderer. That's what he is, a murderer. I'll tell him. You think I won't? I'll tell him to his face. I'll tell him right to his face." In his excitement, he had fallen below the pace, almost stopping, and the soldiers became interested for the first time. "Warning, warning, 48. Gribble faltered to a stop. And then his legs picked up speed. He looked down at his feet as he walked. Soon they were up to where the half-track waited. It began to crawl along beside them again. At about 4:45, Garrity had supper. A tube of processed tuna fish, a few snappy crackers with cheese spread, and a lot of water. He had to force himself to stop there. You could get a canteen any time, but there would be no fresh concentrates until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And he might want a midnight snack. Hell, he might need a midnight snack. "It may be a matter of life and death," Baker said. "But it sure isn't hurting your appetite any." "Can't afford to let it," Garrity answered. "I don't like the idea of fainting about 2 o'clock tomorrow morning." Now there was a genuinely unpleasant thought. You wouldn't know anything, probably. Wouldn't feel anything. You'd just wake up in eternity. "Makes you think, doesn't it?" Baker said softly. Garrity looked at him. In the fading daylight, Baker's face was soft and young and beautiful. "Yeah. I've been thinking about a whole hell of a lot of things." "Such as?" "Him, for one," Garrity said, and jerked his head toward Stebbins, who was still walking along at the same pace he had been walking at when they started out. His pants were drying on him. His face was shadowy. He was still saving his last half-sandwich. "What about him? I wonder why he's here, why he doesn't say anything, and whether he'll live or die." "Garrity, we're all going to die." "But hopefully not tonight," Garrity said. He kept his voice light, but a shudder suddenly racked him. He didn't know if Baker saw it or not. His kidneys contracted. He turned around, unzipped his fly, and began walking backward. "What do you think about the prize?" Baker asked. "I don't see much sense thinking about it," Garrity said, and began to urinate. He finished, zipped his fly, and turned around again, mildly pleased that he had accomplished the operation without drawing a warning. "I think about it," Baker said dreamily. "Not so much the prize itself as the money, all that money." "Rich men don't enter the kingdom of heaven," Garrity said. He watched his feet, the only things that were keeping him from finding out if there really was a kingdom of heaven or not. "Hallelujah," Olson said. "There'll be refreshments after the meeting." "You a religious fella?" Baker asked Garrity. "No, not particularly, but I'm no money freak." "You might be if you grew up on potato soup and collards," Baker said. "Side meat only when your daddy could afford the ammunition." "Might make a difference," Garrity agreed, and then paused, wondering whether to say anything else. "But it's never really the important thing." He saw Baker looking at him uncomprehendingly and a little scornfully. "You can't take it with you, that's your next line," McVries said. Garrity glanced at him. McVries was wearing that irritating slanted smile again. "It's true, isn't it?" he said. "We don't bring anything into the world, and we sure as shit don't take anything out." "Yes, but the period in between those two events is more pleasant in comfort, don't you think?" McVries said. "Oh, comfort shit," Garrity said. "If one of those goons riding that overgrown Tonka toy over there shot you, no doctor in the world could revive you with a transfusion of 20s or 50s. "I ain't dead," Baker said softly. "Yeah, but you could be." Suddenly it was very important to Garrity that he put this across. "What if you won? What if you spent the next 6 weeks planning what you were going to do with the cash? Never mind the prize, just the cash. And what if the first time you went out to buy something, you got flattened by a taxi cab?
Harkness had come over and was now walking beside Olson.
Not me, babe, he said. First thing I'd do is buy a whole fleet of checkers. If I win this, I may never walk again.
You don't understand, Garrity said, more exasperated than ever.
Potato soup or sirloin tips, a mansion or a hovel. Once you're dead, that's it. They put you on the cooling board like Zuck or Ewing, and that's it.
You're better to take it a day at a time, is all I'm saying. If people just took it a day at a time, they'd be a lot happier.
Oh, such a golden flood of bullshit, McVree said.
Is that so? Garrity cried. How much planning are you doing?
Well, right now, I've sort of adjusted my horizons, that's true.
You bet it is, Garrity said grimly. The only difference is we're involved in dying right now.
Total silence followed that.
Harkness took off his glasses and began to polish them.
Olson looked a shade paler.
Garrity wished he hadn't said it. He had gone too far. Then someone in back said, quite clearly, "Hear, hear!" Garrity looked around. Sure it was Stebbins, even though he had never heard Stebbins's voice. But Stebbins gave no sign. He was looking down at the road.
I guess I got carried away, Garrity muttered, even though he wasn't the one who had gotten carried away. That had been Zuck.
Anyone want a cookie?
He handed the cookies around, and it got to be 5 o'clock.
The sun seemed to hang suspended halfway over the horizon. The earth might have stopped turning. The 3 or 4 eager beavers who were still ahead of the pack had dropped back until they were less than 50 yards ahead of the main group. It seemed to Garrity that the road had become a sly combination of upgrades with no corresponding downs. He was thinking that if that were true, they'd all end up breathing through oxygen faceplates before long, when his foot came down on a discarded belt of food concentrates. Surprised, he looked up. It had been Olson's. His hands were twitching at his waist. There was a look of frowning surprise on his face.
I dropped it, he said. I wanted something to eat, and I dropped it.
He laughed as if to show what a silly thing that had been. The laugh stopped abruptly.
I'm hungry, he said.
No one answered. By that time, everyone had gone by, and there was no chance to pick it up. Garrity looked back and saw Olson's food belt lying across the broken white passing line.
I'm hungry,
Olson repeated patiently. The major likes to see someone who's raring to rip. Wasn't that what Olson had said when he came back from getting his number? Olson didn't look quite so raring to rip anymore. Garrity looked at the pockets of his own belt. He had 3 tubes of concentrate left, plus the snappy crackers and the cheese. The cheese was pretty cruddy, though. Here, he said, and gave Olson the cheese. Olson didn't say anything, but he ate the cheese.
Musketeer, McVree said, with that same slanted grin.
By 5:30, the air was smoky with twilight. A few early lightning bugs flitted aimlessly through the air. A ground fog had curdled milkily in the ditches and lower gullies of the fields. Up ahead, someone asked what happened if it got so foggy you walked off the road by mistake. Barkovich's unmistakable voice came back quickly and nastily. What do you think, Dumbo?
4 gone, Garrity thought.
8.5 hours on the road and only 4 gone. There was a small pinched feeling in his stomach. I'll never outlast all of them, he thought.
Not all of them.
But on the other hand, why not? Someone had to. Talk had faded with the daylight. The silence that set in was oppressive. The encroaching dark, the ground mist collecting into small, curdled pools. For the first time, it seemed perfectly real and totally unnatural. And he wanted either Jan or his mother, some woman. And he wondered what in the hell he was doing and how he ever could have gotten involved. He could not even kid himself that everything had not been up front, because it had been, and he hadn't even done it alone. There were currently 95 other fools in this parade. The mucus ball was in his throat again, making it hard to swallow. He realized that someone up ahead was sobbing softly. He had not heard the sound begin, and no one had called his attention to it. It was as if it had been there all along. 10 miles to Caribou now, and at least there would be lights. The thought cheered Garrity a little. It was okay after all, wasn't it? He was alive, and there was no sense thinking ahead to a time when he might not be. As McBreeze had said, it was all a matter of adjusting your horizons. At 6:15, the word came back on a boy named Traven, one of the early leaders who was now falling slowly back through the main group. Traven had diarrhea. Garrity heard it and couldn't believe it was true, but when he saw Traven, he knew that it was. The boy was walking and holding his pants up at the same time. Every time he squatted, he picked up a warning, and Garrity wondered sickly why Traven didn't just let it roll down his legs. Better to be dirty than dead. Traven was bent over, walking like Stebbins with his sandwich, and every time he shuddered, Garrity knew that another stomach cramp was ripping through him. Garrity felt disgusted. There was no fascination in this, no mystery. It was a boy with a bellyache, that was all, and it was impossible to feel anything but disgust and a kind of animal terror. His own stomach rolled queasily. The soldiers were watching Traven very carefully, watching and waiting. Finally, Traven half squatted, half fell, and the soldiers shot him with his pants down. Traven rolled over and grimaced at the sky, ugly and pitiful. Someone retched noisily and was warned. It sounded to Garrity as if he was spewing his belly up whole. "He'll go next," Harkness said in a businesslike way. "Shut up," Garrity choked thickly. "Can't you just shut up?" No one replied. Harkness looked ashamed and began to polish his glasses again. The boy who vomited was not shot. They passed a group of cheering teenagers sitting on a blanket and drinking Cokes. They recognized Garrity and gave him a standing ovation. It made him feel uncomfortable. One of the girls had very large breasts. Her boyfriend was watching them jiggle as she jumped up and down. Garrity decided that he was turning into a sex maniac. "Look at them jahoobies," Pearson said. "Dear, dear me." Garrity wondered if she was a virgin, like he was. They passed by a still, almost perfectly circular pond, faintly misted over. It looked like a gently clouded mirror, and in the mysterious tangle of water plants growing around the edge, a bullfrog croaked hoarsely. Garrity thought the pond was one of the most beautiful things he had ever seen. "This is one hell of a big state," Barkovich said someplace up ahead. "That guy gives me a royal pain in the ass," McBreeze said solemnly. "Right now, my one goal in life is to outlast him." Olson was saying a Hail Mary. Garrity looked at him, alarmed. "How many warnings has he got?" Pearson asked. "None that I know of," Baker said. "Yeah, but he don't look so good." "At this point, none of us do," McBreeze said. Another silence fell. Garrity was aware for the first time that his feet hurt. Not just his legs, which had been troubling him for some time, but his feet. He noticed that he had been unconsciously walking on the outside of the soles, but every now and then he put a foot down flat and winced. He zipped his jacket all the way up and turned the collar against his neck. The air was still damp and raw. "Hey, over there," McBreeze said cheerfully. Garrity and the others looked to the left. They were passing a graveyard, situated atop a small grassy knoll. A fieldstone wall surrounded it, and now the mist was creeping slowly around the leaning gravestones. An angel with a broken wing stared at them with empty eyes. A nuthatch perched atop a rust-flaking flag holder left over from some patriotic holiday, and looked them over perkily. "Our first boneyard," McBreeze said. "It's on your side, Ray. You lose all your points. Remember that game?"
"You talk too goddamn much," Olson said suddenly.
"What's wrong with graveyards, Henry, old buddy? A fine and private place, as the poet said. A nice watertight casket."
"Just shut up!"
"Oh, pickles," McBreeze said. His scar flashed very white in the dying daylight. "You don't really mind the thought of dying, do you, Olson? Like the poet also said, it ain't the dying, it's laying in the grave so long.
Is that what's bugging you, Booby?
McVreeze began to trumpet.
Well, cheer up, Charlie. There's a brighter day come...
Leave him alone, Baker said quietly. Why should I? He's busy convincing himself he can crap out any time he feels like it. That if he just lays down and dies, it won't be as bad as everyone makes out. Well, I'm not going to let him get away with it.
If he doesn't die, you will, Garrity said.
Yeah, I'm remembering, McVreeze said, and gave Garrity his tight, slanted smile. Only this time there was absolutely no humor in it at all. Suddenly, McVreeze looked furious, and Garrity was almost afraid of him. He's the one that's forgetting, this turkey here.
I don't want to do it anymore, Olson said hollowly. I'm sick of it.
Raring to rip, McVreeze said, turning on him. Isn't that what you said? Fuck it, then. Why don't you just fall down and die, then?
Leave him alone, Garrity said.
Listen, Ray.
No, you listen. One Barkovich is enough. Let him do it his own way. No musketeers, remember.
McVreeze smiled again.
Okay, Garrity, you win.
Olson didn't say anything. He just kept picking them up and laying them down.
Full dark had come by 6:30. Caribou, now only 6 miles away, could be seen on the horizon as a dim glow. There were few people along the road to see them into town. They seemed to have all gone home to supper. The mist was chilly around Ray Garrity's feet. It hung over the hills in ghostly, limp banners. The stars were coming brighter overhead, Venus glowing steadily, the Dipper in its accustomed place. He had always been good at the constellations. He pointed out Cassiopeia to Pearson, who only grunted. He thought about Jan, his girl, and felt a twinge of guilt about the girl he had kissed earlier. He couldn't remember exactly what that girl had looked like anymore, but she had excited him. Putting his hand on her ass like that had excited him. What would have happened if he had tried to put his hand between her legs? He felt a clock spring of pressure in his groin that made him wince a little as he walked. Jan had long hair, almost to her waist. She was 16. Her breasts were not as big as those of the girl who had kissed him. He had played with her breasts a lot. It drove him crazy. She wouldn't let him make love to her, and he didn't know how to make her. She wanted to, but she wouldn't. Garrity knew that some boys could do that, could get a girl to go along. But he didn't seem to have quite enough personality, or maybe not quite enough will, to convince her. He wondered how many of the others here were virgins. Gribble had called the major a murderer. He wondered if Gribble was a virgin. He decided Gribble probably was. They passed the Caribou city limits. There was a large crowd there, and a news truck from one of the networks. A battery of lights bathed the road in a warm white glare. It was like walking into a sudden warm lagoon of sunlight, wading through it, and then emerging again. A fat newspaper man in a three-piece suit trotted along with them, poking his long-reach microphone at different walkers. Behind him, two technicians busily unreeled a drum of electric cable. How do you feel?
Okay, I guess I feel okay.
Feeling tired?
Yeah, well, you know. Yeah, but I'm still okay.
What do you think your chances are now?
I don't know.
Okay, I guess. I still feel pretty strong. He asked a big bull of a fellow, Scram, what he thought of the long walk. Scram grinned, said he thought it was the biggest fucking thing he'd ever seen, and the reporter made snipping motions with his fingers at the two technicians. One of them nodded back wearily. Shortly afterward, he ran out of microphone cable and began wending his way back toward the mobile unit, trying to avoid the tangles of unreeled cord. The crowd, drawn as much by the TV crew as by the long walkers themselves, cheered enthusiastically. Posters of the major were raised and lowered rhythmically on sticks so raw and new they were still bleeding sap. When the cameras panned over them, they cheered more frantically than ever and waved to Aunt Betty and Uncle Fred. They rounded a bend and passed a small shop where the owner, a little man wearing stained whites, had set up a soft drink cooler with a sign over it which read, On the House for the Long Walkers, courtesy of Ev's Market. A police cruiser was parked close by, and two policemen were patiently explaining to Ev, as they undoubtedly did every year, that it was against the rules for spectators to offer any kind of aid or assistance, including soft drinks, to the walkers.
They passed by the Caribou Paper Mills Incorporated, a huge soot-blackened building on a dirty river. The workers were lined up against the cyclone fences, cheering good-naturedly and waving. A whistle blew as the last of the walkers, Stebbins, passed by, and Garrity, looking back over his shoulder, saw them trooping inside again. "Did he ask you?" a strident voice inquired of Garrity. With a feeling of great weariness, Garrity looked down at Gary Barkovich. "Did who ask me what?"
"The reporter, Dumbo. Did he ask you how you felt?"
"No, he didn't get to me." He wished Barkovich would go away. He wished the throbbing pain in the soles of his feet would go away.
"They asked me," Barkovich said. "You know what I told them?"
"Uh-uh."
"I told them I felt great,"
Barkovich said aggressively. The rain hat was still flopping in his back pocket.
"I told them I felt real strong. I told them I felt prepared to go on forever. And you know what else I told them?"
"Oh, shut up," Pearson said.
"Who asked you, long, tall, and ugly?" Barkovich said.
"Go away," McVree said. "You give me a headache." Insulted once more, Barkovich moved on up the line and grabbed Collie Parker.
"Did he ask you what?"
"Get out of here before I pull your fucking nose off and make you eat it," Collie Parker snarled. Barkovich moved on quickly. The word on Collie Parker was that he was one mean son of a bitch.
"That guy drives me up a wall," Pearson said.
"He'd be glad to hear it," McVree said. "He likes it. He also told the reporter that he planned to dance on a lot of graves. He means it, too. That's what keeps him going."
"Next time he comes around, I think I'll trip him," Olson said. His voice sounded dull and drained.
"Tut-tut," McVree said. "Rule 8, no interference with your fellow walkers."
"You know what you can do with Rule 8, Olson said with a pallid smile.
"Watch out," McVree's grinned.
"You're starting to sound pretty lively again."
By 7 p.m., the pace, which had been lagging very close to the minimum limit, began to pick up a little. It was cool, and if you walked faster, you kept warmer. They passed beneath the turnpike overpass, and several people cheered them around mouthfuls of Dunkin' Donuts from the glass-walled shop situated near the base of the exit ramp.
"We join up with the turnpike someplace, don't we?" Baker asked.
"In Old Town," Garrity said.
"Approximately 120 miles.
Harkness whistled through his teeth.
Not long after that, they walked into downtown Caribou. They were 44 miles from their starting point.
Chapter 4. The ultimate game show would be one where the losing contestant was killed. Chuck Barris, game show creator, MC of The Gong Show. Everyone was disappointed with Caribou. It was just like limestone. The crowds were bigger, but otherwise it was just another mill, pulp, and service town with a scattering of stores and gas stations, one shopping center that was having, according to the signs plastered everywhere, our annual walk-in for values sale, and a park with a war memorial in it. A small, evil-sounding high school band struck up the national anthem, then a medley of Sousa marches, and then, with taste so bad it was almost grisly, marching to Pretoria. The same woman who had made a fuss at the crossroads so far back turned up again. She was still looking for Percy. This time she made it through the police cordon and right onto the road. She pawed through the boys, unintentionally tripping one of them up. She was yelling for her Percy to come home now. The soldiers went for their guns, and for a moment it looked very much as if Percy's mom was going to buy herself an interference ticket. Then a cop got an arm lock on her and dragged her away. A small boy sat on a Keep Maine Tidy barrel and ate a hot dog and watched the cops put Percy's mom in a police cruiser. Percy's mom was the high point of going through Caribou.
"What comes after Old Town, Ray?" McVries asked.
"I'm not a walking road map," Garrity said irritably. "Bangor, I guess. Then Augusta. Then Kittery and the state line, about 330 miles from here, give or take."
"Okay, I'm picked clean."
Somebody whistled.
330 miles.
"It's unbelievable," Harkness said gloomily.
"The whole damn thing is unbelievable," McVree said. "I wonder where the major is."
"Shacked up in Augusta," Olson said. They all grinned. and Garrity reflected how strange it was about the Major who had gone from God to Mammon in just 10 hours. 95 left. But that wasn't even the worst anymore. The worst was trying to visualize McVries buying it, or Baker, or Harkness with his silly book idea. His mind shied away from the thought. Once Caribou was behind them, the road became all but deserted. They walked through a country crossroads with a single light pole rearing high above, spotlighting them and making crisp black shadows as they passed through the glare. Far away, a train whistle hooted. The moon cast a dubious light on the ground fog, leaving it pearly and opalescent in the fields. Garrity took a drink of water.
Warning! Warning 12! This is your final warning 12!
12 was a boy named Fenter, who was wearing a souvenir t-shirt, which read, "I rode the Mount Washington Cog Railway." Fenter was licking his lips. The word was that his foot had stiffened up on him badly. When he was shot 10 minutes later, Garrity didn't feel much. He was too tired. He walked around Fenter. Looking down, he saw something glittering in Fenter's hand, a St. Christopher's medal. "If I get out of this," McVries said abruptly, "you know what I'm going to do?"
"What?" Baker asked.
"Fornicate until my cock turns blue. I've never been so horny in my life as I am right this minute at 7:45 on May 1st.
"You mean it?"
Garrity asked.
"I do," McVries assured.
"I could even get horny for you, Ray, if you didn't need a shave."
Garrity laughed.
"Prince Charming, that's who I am," McVries said. His hand went to the scar on his cheek and touched it. "Now all I need is a sleeping beauty. I could awake her with a big sloppy soul kiss, and the two of us would ride away into the sunset. At least as far as the nearest Holiday Inn."
"Walk," Olson said listlessly.
"Huh?"
"Walk into the sunset."
"Walk into the sunset, okay," McVries said.
"True love either way.
Do you believe in true love, Hank, dear?"
"I believe in a good screw," Olson said, and Art Baker burst out laughing.
"I believe in true love," Garrity said, and then felt sorry he had said it. It sounded naive.
"You want to know why I don't?" Olson said. He looked up at Garrity and grinned a scary, furtive grin. "Ask Fenter. Ask Zuck. They know."
"That's a hell of an attitude," Pearson said. He had come out of the dark from someplace and was walking with them again. Pearson was limping, not badly, but very obviously limping.
"No, it's not," McVries said. And then, after a moment, he added cryptically, "Nobody loves a deader."
"Edgar Allan Poe did," Baker said. "I did a report on him in school, and it said he had tendencies that were necrophiliac, Garrity said.
"Yeah, that's right."
"What's that?" Pearson asked.
"It means you got an urge to sleep with a dead woman," Baker said. "Or a dead man, if you're a woman."
"Or if you're a fruit," McVries put in.
"How the hell did we get on this?" Olson croaked. "Just how in the hell did we get on the subject of screwing dead people? It's fucking repulsive."
"Why not?" a deep, somber voice said. It was Abraham, too. He was tall and disjointed-looking. He walked in a perpetual shamble. "I think we all might take a moment or two to stop and think about whatever kind of sex life there may be in the next world."
"I get Marilyn Monroe," McVries said. "You can have Eleanor Roosevelt, Abel, buddy."
Abraham gave him the finger. Up ahead, one of the soldiers droned out a warning.
"Just a second now. Just one motherfucking second here."
Olson spoke slowly, as if he wrestled with a tremendous problem in expression.
"You're all off the subject. All off."
"The Transcendental Quality of Love," a lecture by the noted philosopher and Ethiopian jug rammer Henry Olson, McVries said, author of "A Peach Is Not a Peach Without a Pit," and other works of...
"Wait!"
Olson cried out. His voice was as shrill as broken glass.
"You wait just one goddamn second. Love is a put-on. It's nothing. One big fat El Zilcho. You got it?"
No one replied. Garrity looked out ahead of him, where the dark charcoal hills met the star-punched darkness of the sky. He wondered if he couldn't feel the first faint twinges of a Charlie horse in the arch of his left foot. "I want to sit down," he thought irritably. Damn it all, I want to sit down.
Love is a fake, Olson was blaring. There are three great truths in the world, and they are a good meal, a good screw, and a good shit, and that's all.
And when you get like Fenter and Zuck...
Shut up, a bored voice said, and Garrity knew it was Stebbins. But when he looked back, Stebbins was only looking at the road and walking along near the left-hand edge. A jet passed overhead, trailing the sound of its engines behind it and chalking a feathery line across the night sky. It passed low enough for them to be able to see its running lights pulsing yellow and green. Baker was whistling again. Garrity let his eyelids drop mostly shut. His feet moved on their own. His half-dozing mind began to slip away from him. Random thoughts began to chase each other lazily across its field. He remembered his mother singing him an Irish lullaby when he was very small. Something about cockles and muscles alive, alive, oh. And her face so huge and beautiful, like the face of an actress on a movie screen. Wanting to kiss her and be in love with her for always. When he grew up, he would marry her. This was replaced by Jan's good-humored Polish face and her dark hair that streamed nearly to her waist. She was wearing a two-piece bathing suit beneath a short beach coat because they were going to Reed Beach. Garrity himself was wearing a ragged pair of denim shorts and his Zoris. Jan was gone. Her face became that of Jimmy Owens, the kid down the block from them. He had been five and Jimmy had been five, and Jimmy's mother had caught them playing doctor's office in the sand pit behind Jimmy's house. They both had boners. That's what they called them, boners. Jimmy's mother had called his mother, and his mother had come to get him and had sat him down in her bedroom and had asked him how he would like it if she made him go out and walk down the street with no clothes on. His dozing body contracted with the groveling embarrassment of it, the deep shame. He had cried and begged not to make him walk down the street with no clothes on, and not to tell his father. 7 years old now. He and Jimmy Owens peering through the dirt-grimed windows of the Burr's building materials office at the Naked Lady calendars, knowing what they were looking at, but not really knowing, feeling a crawling, shameful, exciting pang of something. Of something. There had been one blonde lady with a piece of blue silk draped across her hips, and they had stared at it for a long, long time. They argued about what might be down there under the cloth. Jimmy said he had seen his mother naked. Jimmy said he knew. Jimmy said it was hairy and cut open. He had refused to believe Jimmy, because what Jimmy said was disgusting. Still, he was sure that ladies must be different from men down there, and they had spent a long purple summer dusk discussing it, swatting mosquitoes and watching a scratch baseball game in the lot of the moving van company across the street from Burr's. He could actually feel in the half-waking dream the sensation of the hard curb beneath his fanny. The next year he had hit Jimmy Owens in the mouth with the barrel of his Daisy air rifle while they were playing guns, and Jimmy had to have 4 stitches in his upper lip. A year after that, they had moved away. He hadn't meant to hit Jimmy in the mouth. It had been an accident. Of that he was quite sure, even though by then he had known Jimmy was right because he had seen his own mother naked. He had not meant to see her naked. It had been an accident. They were hairy down there, hairy and cut open. Shh, it isn't a tiger, love, only your teddy bear, see? Cockles and muscles, alive, alive, oh. Mother loves her boy. Shh, go to sleep.
Warning, warning, 47.
An elbow poked him rudely in the ribs. That's you, boy, rise and shine. McVries was grinning at him.
What time is it? Garrity asked thickly.
8:35.
But I've been dozing for hours, McVries said. I know the feeling.
Well, it sure seems that way.
It's your mind, McVries said, using the old escape hatch. Don't you wish your feet could?
I use dial, Pearson said, pulling an idiotic face. Don't you wish everybody did?
Garrity thought that memories were like a line drawn in the dirt. The further back you went, the scuffier and harder to see that line got, until finally there was nothing but smooth sand and the black hole of nothingness that you came out of. The memories were, in a way, like the road. Here it was real and hard and tangible, but that early road, that 9-in-the-morning road, was far back and meaningless. They were almost 50 miles into the walk. The word came back that the major would be by in his jeep to review them and make a short speech when they actually got to the 50-mile point. Garrity thought that was most probably horseshit. They breasted a long, steep rise, and Garrity was tempted to take his jacket off again. He didn't. He unzipped it, though, and then walked backward for a minute. The lights of Caribou twinkled at him, and he thought about Lot's wife, who had looked back and turned into a pillar of salt. Warning! Warning 47! Second warning 47! It took Garrity a moment to realize it was him. His second warning in 10 minutes! He started to feel afraid again. He thought of the unnamed boy who had died because he had slowed down once too often. Was that what he was doing? He looked around. McVries, Harkness, Baker, and Olson were all staring at him. Olson was having a particularly good look. He could make out the intent expression on Olson's face even in the dark. Olson had outlasted 6. He wanted to make Garrity lucky 7. He wanted Garrity to die. "See anything green?" Garrity asked irritably. "No," Olson said, his eyes sliding away. "Of course not." Garrity walked with determination now, his arms swinging aggressively. It was 20 to 9. At 20 to 11, 8 miles down the road, he would be free again. He felt an hysterical urge to proclaim he could do it. They needn't send the word back on him. They weren't going to watch him get a ticket. At least not yet. End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.